Get ready for Big Guy Small Talk.
We're just going to chat. Introduce yourself, though, because I always forget to tell people to do that because we just start talking. And then if at some point I realize, like, we should... Like, don't think just because you've introduced yourself, everything you say afterwards is going to be part of it.
So yeah, yeah.
We can still have, like, more casual combo.
That sounds good. Yeah, totally. So, I'm Will Spearman. I'm a data scientist at a company called Huddle. I work in soccer analytics, live here in Dallas, Texas. Former life, I was a physicist, did my PhD at Harvard, and then worked on the discovery of the Higgs boson. Over at CERN, before finally transitioning away from physics.
So, jeez,
that's me.
I feel dumb.
Oh gosh, yeah, this is one of the smartest guys I know here.
Bro, no, not even.
Come on.
Even close. I know so many smart people.
You can ask me questions about math, and I'll just be lost.
What do you What is a data scientist?
That's a good question.
Right?
Yeah. What is a data scientist? I think if you can answer that.
Pause. Sorry. Yep. Don't bang on the table.
Oh, okay.
And just talk clearly. That's okay. All. Sorry. We'll start over. What is a data scientist? Oh, he's sipping beer. I gotta get my beer.
Okay.
Go ahead. Do it.
Yep.
Talk on, bro.
A data scientist. That is a really good question. It's the sort of thing that I think if you can answer that, you could probably get a job writing articles about what a data scientist is, because nobody really knows. It's kind of, it's definitely very new job that's still kind of being defined, and I think it's being defined in a very kind of functional way. So I think every time you do something as somebody with the job title of data scientist, you're actually defining what a data scientist is. I'd say classically it probably kind of splits into two skill sets. One is more like modeling, statistical modeling, Bayesian modeling, machine learning, classification, and then the second one would be kind of big data, data warehousing, data access, databases. And I think both of those are like very important skill sets that really tie into what the current definition of a data scientist is.
Database sucks.
It really does.
Keeping like taking care of databases sucks. It's not as fun.
It's like herding cats.
Modeling's way cooler.
You Unfortunately, can try, but you're going to end up really unhappy and scratches all over it.
It seems cool. Like, oh, big data sounds really cool. It's really just hating your life.
Pretty much.
So thank you, Amazon, for solving a lot of people's problems.
They fixed a lot of problems. Yeah, it's pretty impressive how Amazon has kind of, you know, come to the forefront of this field. Because I know, you know, Google's got their own kind of in-house solution. But they just never really decided to market it as aggressively as Amazon did.
Yeah, I was talking to a lady yesterday.
Yeah.
And she was like... she was talking about Azure versus AWS.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I would definitely prefer AWS. And she's like, why? And I was like, well, because Azure is Windows. And if you want to do anything in machine learning, you should not be in Windows.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You should definitely go to Amazon.
That's true. Funny though, that Microsoft has actually become very open source friendly.
Is it?
I would, as a, you know, as a programmer, I now think of Microsoft is actually the one that's friendlier to open source, friendlier even to like Linux than Mac.
Perhaps,
and
I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's because Microsoft's kind of recognized, you know, their place kind of in the marketplace.
Yeah.
As
we give you a computer to turn into a Linux.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, if Linux is clearly not a competitor for UI.
Yeah, definitely not.
Like, there's no real Linux front end that's going to be fun to work in. So you got to use Windows if you want to use your PC as a PC.
Yeah, I just like, I guess my only beef with Windows is that TensorFlow is still only compatible with Python 3.
Yeah.
And not Python 2.
Huh, I didn't Windows. Know that.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
Dude, like, you should need switching Linux to Python that. 3. It's the way of the future.
I do Python 3 now, and I
can't be a dinosaur about
this. What I don't like about Python 3 is like, you have to call things lists, you know, like if you want to get a list of a range, you have to go list range instead of
Yeah.
It just, because it's a generator now.
Those four letters function. Make it pretty much unusable. Yeah.
So that's kind of annoying. But at the same time, and the and parentheses and print functions.
Yeah.
Why do they do that?
I don't know. I think it's standardization, because
print with other languages, you mean?
And also just it's structurally it makes more sense. You know, print, like, I think it's a nod to the fact that Python can be treated as a functional language.
Yeah.
You know, because so it's sorry. Not. Yes.
Sorry. By functional language, we mean put shit in parentheses.
That's fair.
That's
yeah.
like
yeah.
basically.
Well, originally, I think the definition of functional is that you don't have variables.
Yeah.
Nothing. There's no things can't change. Basically, mm-hmm. a functional language is you define processes and then you run those processes on constants, and that's yeah. the application. Whereas a normal language is we are in the weeds. Okay.
Yeah, you're a nerd, bro.
I'm a nerd.
See, we could talk about this forever. So this is why I'm here to. Although
somebody's
got to
moderate.
I love this stuff.
Yeah, somebody's yeah. got to rein
yeah,
us in
we,
here.
We need a third person here.
We do.
Keeping us on track. So all right. So you went to Harvard. But before Harvard, I want to talk about the Higgs boson thing.
Okay.
So
okay.
you were part of the team that discovered the Higgs boson part.
I'll
let you talk about it.
Yeah, sure. No, I was just part of a select group of like around 5,000 people.
Of the world, though.
Yes, but that's, when you consider how many particle physicists there are in the world, like that's the majority. Of
is
them.
There at least over 50,000?
No, particle physicists?
Yeah.
I would say about half of them were working at CERN. You think I'm joking. I'm really not. Like,
all of them.
The only other particle... So I should clarify. Experimental and theoretical are the two kind of branches of particle physics. Theoretical is the smart one. So like if Raf was to become a physicist, he would be a theoretical physicist because they do math. They're
yeah.
smart. They can handle stuff.
That's
the
true.
Experimentalists are the ones who can solder things.
Yeah, fuck that.
Exactly. So yeah. we were the... Of the experimental particle physicists, probably about half were at CERN. I'm just pulling this number out of thin air, but that would be my guess.
And CERN being the lab in Switzerland.
Yeah, the European Organization for Nuclear Research.
Right. So CERN has this huge particle collider.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
Yep, particle collider.
And how big is it?
I think it's 27 kilometers in circumference, maybe 28, something
yeah.
like that. So... It's pretty big. If you drive around it, it'll take a little while. And it's pretty much located on the Swiss-French border. The dimensions of it were actually limited by the geography. So on one side you have a lake, on the other side you have the mountains, and they're like, well, let's see what we can fit in here. And it's about 27 kilometers. So
and they just made this huge particle.
They just made this big ring. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But you're just banging. Does it look like air when particles hit each other? Like without using specific
without having a detector.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think you're even producing enough photo. You might see like a tiny, like I think there is a tiny flash. That's the only thing that would be optical is a few photons, but most of them are going to be at energies that are way too high for the human eye to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you would see anything.
Damn.
Yeah. It's just ultra high energy X-rays,
yeah.
gamma rays.
So then the Higgs boson, what is that?
The Higgs boson, it's kind of like midichlorians, you know, it binds the universe together. No, it's
no midichlorians, please.
No.
Never
okay.
again.
Should we
oh, are
pause?
The nachos ready?
Yeah,
we're going to eat nachos.
Okay.
We'll be back in like 10 minutes, people. Maybe longer. Oh, that was good. All right, we're back. We just ate some nachos.
Hey.
Delicious. We're definitely talking about Catholic stuff, so we're not talking about that right now. I want you to talk about the Higgs boson particle.
Yes, the Higgs boson. I try to do a better explanation now. So
some food in you?
With some food in me.
Some beer.
Exactly. So basically the Higgs boson is whoa.
I'm gonna get here.
Okay. So we can look at each other? That's a good idea.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put this here.
Okay.
We're just gonna let this record all this noise.
Excellent.
All right, man.
Cool.
Tell the people about the Higgs boson. Get
Higgs boson.
Yep.
So the Higgs boson, it's kind of an antique, actually, because it was predicted, I think, back in like the 60s or the 70s. It's been conceptualized for a long time, and it's kind of the way I like to think of it is the duct tape that holds the Standard Model together. So it's this part.
What do you mean by standard model?
Standard model of particle physics is kind of the this predictive model that was developed, I believe, during the 70s that predicts the existence of kind of all of the different subatomic particles that have been discovered.
So it's a model that we use to predict
it's a model,
everything that we've been finding.
Exactly. So we've been finding over the last, you know, 40, 50 years, like a lot of different particles, but none of them were terribly surprising. And the reason is because they all were different combinations of particles that we already believe exist, which mm-hmm. is the quarks, electrons, muons.
Pions.
Pions are actually a...
what are they?
They are a superposition of two quarks. So that would be a quark-antiquark.
So they're a quark and an anti-quark.
That have, like, joined up, basically. So,
but they don't eliminate?
No, no. So they're, like, orbiting each other.
They're dancing.
They're kind of dancing.
So a pion is a quark and an anti-quark
exactly.
that are dancing.
Yeah. It gets weird.
I wish you
would have
told me that in quantum, because I didn't know what pions were.
Well, they can also be treated as a force carrier themselves, which is a weird thing. So right now we believe that there's basically four fundamental forces. So there's gravity. And you can kind of think of gravity. The way I like to think of it is how the charge works. So gravity, anything with mass attracts anything else with mass. Mm-hmm. That's cool, right? Electricity and magnetism, anything with a positive charge attracts anything with a negative charge. So gravity, there's only one charge, mass. Electricity and magnetism, there's two, positive, negative. Well, guess what? There's one with three.
Yeah.
It's called the strong force. And with that, you've got red, green, and blue, we call them. And when you have red, green, and blue, those three attract each other. And then anti-red will attract red, anti-blue will attract
blue. So red, green, and blue attract each other?
Basically.
Go ahead and get closer. Sorry, man.
Yeah.
I know you have to lean.
Okay.
So don't be afraid to, like...
lean in.
F up your posture for this podcast.
Perfect.
So red, green, and blue attract each other.
Yep.
And then what happens with red and anti-red?
Red and anti-red also attract each other. So you can have effectively... the way you can think of it is to have a stable particle... a stable electromagnetic particle, you've got to have like an electron and a proton, right? You know, that'd be
stable.
A stable because it's positive and negative. To have a stable colored particle, so to have a particle that's like color mm-hmm. stable, you have to have either red, green, and blue or
red
and anti-red.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Oh, so when you mean red, green, and blue attract each other, you mean all three of them.
Well,
not
yeah,
red
so
attracts green, green attracts
no,
red, green
no.
attracts blue.
And I don't really mean attract. I just mean that those are color neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So that
so when you put them together,
then you put them together, there's no net force.
Right.
Yeah. So that those can be. And the weird thing about the strong force.
And they're not actually colored this way.
They're not actually colored.
People think.
We just use it as an analogy.
There's
basically.
Some crazy ass names for particles or quarks, even like the quarks are up quark,
up
down quark,
down quark,
top
quark, bottom quark,
strange.
Strange and charmed. Exactly.
Yeah. That's stupid.
It's ridiculous.
You could call them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
you
6.
Could.
And it would mean
you
the
could.
Same thing.
It would probably be better. no, I think most people when they learn this for the first time, like are picturing these different colors and they're like, and then they're like, wait, but colors come from electricity and magnetism. And then so it's not really colored, but it's just how the math comes out.
And do they have mass?
They do. They do. They actually have, some of them have quite a bit of mass. So like the top and the bottom quark are pretty heavy as far as subatomic.
Pretty heavy, what do you mean? Like are they heavier than
the top
an electron?
Quark is actually, yes.
Because electron is massless, right?
Nope. Electron has mass.
I hope no one that
electron
knows me
has mass.
To this. So the electron has mass.
The electron has mass, yeah.
Oh, it has to have mass.
It has mass, yes.
It has to.
It has to.
Like by the way it works with.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
My apologies.
Anyway, so these quarks, you know, electrons, muons, tauons, like this is all described by the standard model.
Mm-hmm.
There was one missing piece, though, and it was basically what gave these things mass. We saw that they had mass, but there was no way in the theory for them to actually have a mass term. So, like, if you tried to add it, it just broke the theory. And so somebody came up with this clever mathematical trick. They call it the Higgs field, and they said, what if we just made up this field that is everywhere in the universe, and that when interacting with this field, they might not really have mass, but they act like they have mass.
Sounds like something a mathematician would say.
Exactly.
Just what if this thing existed?
And so they're like, well, one of the predictions of this crazy idea is that there should be a Higgs boson, and that we should be able to discover it if we hit high enough energies and smash stuff together fast enough.
How do you make high enough energies?
So you basically, there's there's a number of different ways, but they're all accelerators. Pretty much any charged particle, you can put it in a magnetic field and accelerate it.
Okay.
Or in a electric field and accelerate it.
And by then accelerate it, you mean?
Take it from at rest to moving real fast.
Yeah. Almost speed of light.
Close to the speed of light, yeah. So you know, there's linear accelerators, which means that you kind of take it from rest at one point, and then you accelerate it in a straight line.
Gradually.
And until, you know, it's moving at some speed, and then you slam it into a target. And that's how a lot of particle physics has been done. You take protons or electrons.
So how are they getting these particles to begin with?
You just take hydrogen gas, actually, and you strip off the electrons.
How do you take off the electrons of hydrogen gas?
You ionize it. And for that, you would have to ask a detector physicist, because I don't really know.
You got to strip the electrons.
Yeah.
And then that leaves you with just protons and neutrons.
Just a straight proton. Oh, wait. Hydrogen's just a proton and an electron.
Right?
Yeah, so you strip off the electron, right, and you've got this proton, and then you can do whatever you want with it. So pretty much what we do is we have this ring, and the reason it's a ring is so that you can keep using those same accelerators, 27 kilometers
in
circumference.
Yeah, so by the ring, he means the big-ass CERN lab.
Yes, it's huge.
It doesn't mean a small little...
No, it's 27 kilometers in circumference. It'll take you, 20 minutes to drive around it, even if there was no traffic.
So you have this ring.
You have this ring, and in the ring, there's two things. There's magnets, and there's, like, electric field producers. And the electric fields, those speed up the protons, and the magnets bend them. So the magnets keep it going in a circle, and the electric field keeps the protons getting faster and faster and faster.
Right.
And eventually, you'll hit this point where the amount of energy that these protons going in the circle radiate is the same as your acceleration of them. And so that's the maximum speed they can hit. And it's like arbitrarily close to the speed of light. So you got these protons going at effectively the speed of light, and you slam them into each other.
So this has always been confusing to me, and I think as you're explaining this, I'm starting to kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
But so you have protons, right?
Right.
Do you have some protons going in one direction, some in the other?
Exactly.
And the only reason they don't collide earlier is they're not going fast enough to create a collision?
It's actually even simpler than that.
Oh, shit.
You've got two tubes.
Oh.
And you got
just
two tubes.
Join them together.
And then there's a few points along this giant ring where you can focus the two beams into each other.
So you have two different beams.
You have two different beams going in opposite directions.
Okay.
And
well, I did not understand anything. Then.
You can focus. And there's various points that are called interaction points along this 27 kilometers.
That?
Sure. There's various points. So if you want to... If you want to slam your protons together, you've got two beams going in opposite directions, and you can use the magnets to change their direction just ever so slightly because the beams are a few centimeters away from each other.
But by beams, they're not in like pipes, right? These are just light beams?
They're actually in pipes.
So it is, okay, so these are
they're in pipes.
Physical pipes.
They're physical pipes, but the beams themselves, it's a vacuum in there.
Right. Oh, it's a vacuum.
It's a vacuum in there, except for these like, a few million protons.
And the thing speeding them up then is the electromagnetic field.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And if I said a million and there's somebody who actually is at CERN and listening to me, they probably know that number is wrong by a few orders of magnitude. but I'm trying here.
Yeah. So then how are you... So you're just... So essentially, it's just like a big hydrogen gas train.
Yeah, pretty much.
And just then before,
ionized hydrogen
before anything
is
goes,
slamming around.
They strip the electrons.
Strip the electrons.
And you get to go on the train.
Yep. It's a little... Like, the funny thing is... Effectively, it's like education. You gotta get up to the big train. So you gotta go through like five or so smaller rings. So once you
smaller, do you mean like more on the inside?
Yeah. So like, there's one ring. I think that's the size of a room, and that accelerates these protons to faster. Then you inject them to a bigger one, which is like one of them's like a few hundred meters. One of them's like about I think maybe 2 kilometers. And then one of them is the 27 kilometers. So you gradually accelerate them until they're kind of ready for the big time.
And then they just hit each other.
And then they hit each other and sparks fly. Yep.
Have you ever been expecting them to hit each other and they didn't? You know, like, what happened?
Yeah, so there's what's called quenching. And quenching is basically when you lose control of the beam and, like, just, it's not good. The beam.
Everyone's mad.
Yeah, it's like the magnets aren't focused right and the beam will slam into the wall or slam into something.
Are the magnets just not fixed?
Forever? Yes, sometimes.
So they move them?
They can get moved. For the most part, yeah, the magnets don't, like, break very often. But one thing that can happen, and this actually did happen in the early days of CERN, is these magnets, because they need to be extremely powerful, are actually superconducting, which means they need to be kept at very, very, very cold. The quenching is actually what happens in the magnets. And so that's when the magnetic field the magnet warms up, basically, and it's no longer superconducting. So you've got, to make the magnetic field, you've actually got electricity running through the magnets.
Right.
When the magnet heats up, it's no longer as conductive. So all this electricity just, like, basically explodes the magnet. So the magnet can physically explode. And, like, this happened, and there was actually, like, this kind of small explosion in the tunnel. And it took, like, months and months and months to fix.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we don't like it when that happens.
Sorry. Hold on. Still getting over my... I had the flu 2 weeks ago. So are you... Okay. So at any point when these magnets are on and particles are flying, are people walking around in the tunnels?
No, right, okay. No. This is bad news. Right? This is like being in space unprotected type of bad news.
So is the whole tunnel a vacuum?
The whole tunnel is not. So there's air in the tunnel. There's
electricity and...
There's effective... like, so there's actually two tunnels. There's the tunnel in the ground, which you can walk around in. And that's maybe... that's about like twice the height of a man, maybe. You know, like... twice, something like 5 meters or something.
This is America.
Feet. 5 yards. Happy.
Yards are okay. Half of a first
down. Within this, you know, 5 yard, 10 yard, however big it is, tunnel, which you can walk around. Heck, you can even drive a little cart around it. Like, it's actually got a paved bottom that you can just drive these little carts around. Within that, there's up on like cinder blocks or some sort of stand. I forget what the stand is like. There's actually the beam itself, which is a tube. And that's got magnets around it. It's got these electrical field generators that accelerate it. Pretty much everything that's required to control the proton beams is in this little tube that goes around this big ring. And so in that tube, there's a complete vacuum. And if you were down in the tunnel when the beam was going around, there'd be quite a bit of radiation, both coming off of the beam and whenever there's an interaction. So whenever the beams hit each other, that creates a lot of radiation.
Yeah.
And there's radiation just coming off of the beam itself. So you don't want to be down there.
It's bad news bears.
Yeah.
So then, okay.
There's all sorts of interlocks to make sure, like, if somebody's been down there, you actually have a biometric scan, so you have to, like, scan your eyeball to go down into the tunnel. So the system knows that you're down there, and you have to...
Does it shut off when someone's trying to get down, or does it...
I think there's interlocks that will, like, have, like, big red flashing signs if anybody's trying to turn it on. Even when they're turning the beam on, even if they're, you know, even if everybody's clearly out, like, all sorts of red lights start flashing. Jeez. Like, yeah.
Did you ever see... what was the craziest thing you ever saw? What was the most dangerous thing you ever saw?
Well, probably some of the waste.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, there was some...
Is CERN going to sue you for this?
I hope not. But... they try to be, you know, so they have all these safety courses and they, like, show you these images of people who, like, took home a piece of radioactive material in their back pocket and it just, like, irradiated their butt and they had to get, like, their entire butt removed because it turned necrotic in, like, a day. So they try to put the fear of radiation in you pretty strong when you first show up there. And then they have another course when you actually go down into the tunnel and another one when you go into the interaction chambers. So you're pretty well educated on, like, what not to do, but there have been some situations where, like, I've seen people with, like, lightly irradiated things, just, like, putting it in their car, not following the proper procedures. But for the most part, CERN's pretty safe. Like, there's nothing really that can go wrong there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great place.
Great place.
Great place. You were how old when you were there?
when I first went there, I think I was 18. Yeah. Yeah, I was 18. Maybe 19. Yeah, so I went there. So I went with Raphael, actually. We both went to the University of Dallas as undergraduates. And I
He was smarter than me.
That's false. But I got the opportunity to go to CERN for a summer.
Almost objectively true, but keep going.
Not going to argue this with somebody who's smarter than me. It's a losing battle. You're smarter and you'll convince everybody that I'm smarter. It's not fair.
So keep going.
So I went to CERN as an undergraduate, and that was my first experience. And then I went back to do a Fulbright and did research there for a year, and then I went back as a graduate student. So I can't quit that place.
Shit.
Yeah.
That's a lot of...
A lot of CERN.
Yeah.
A lot of CERN.
In Switzerland, right?
Yep.
And so you climbed a lot of mountains?
I did, yeah. Yeah, so I grew up in very flat places.
Texas.
I was born in Chicago.
You're born in Chicago.
I was born in Chicago, yeah. And I spent a lot of my life actually in Georgia and Texas. So I grew up in Georgia and Texas mostly. I mean, I left Chicago when I was like six. Mm-hmm. So when I first went over to Switzerland, like Geneva, CERN, this big collider that we're talking about is actually about 100 miles away from the highest mountain in the Alps. You can see it from pretty much every like second floor office window. And I remember seeing that Mont Blanc. I remember seeing that and thinking like, that's freaking insane.
I'm climbing that.
No, at first I was like, that's freaking insane. And then I met some nerdy Polish guys who had climbed it. And I was like, psh, that guy looks scrawny. That scrawny guy can do that. So can I. So.
So he must have been scrawny.
He was very scrawny. Yeah, so I found a friend and we started climbing mountains, and next thing you know, I'm addicted. So I've climbed Mont Blanc, the Matterhorn, not the one in Disneyland.
If you followed Will while he was at CERN, you would think he did no work.
It's what my advisor thought.
He was
definitely what my advisor thought. It's pretty much what everybody at Harvard thought, actually. So yeah. You would not have been alone in thinking that.
Yeah. Just like, does he do any work? And it's like, nope,
not a whole lot. No, yeah. No.
That's cool though.
Yeah. It was a good time. It was a good time.
Have you almost died while climbing a mountain?
There've been a few close calls.
What kind of climbing do you do, first of all, for people who give a shit about climbing?
Well, it's, let's see. So I do ice climbing, I do rock climbing, and I do, you know, kind of general hiking, mountaineering.
Which one's the most dangerous?
Well, it's usually the most dangerous when you combine all three.
So
if there's a mountain where you need to have the gear for ice, for rock, and for snow, that's probably going to be the most dangerous. I think the sort of rock climbing you're going to be doing in Texas, you know, just climbing up a rock wall is pretty safe generally. The mountains kind of throw a whole new element because things like to fall down. Rocks like to fall down. Ice likes to fall down. Snow likes to fall down. Like the mountain just trying to kill you. it actually doesn't care. It's just doing its thing, and you happen to be there when it's doing its thing.
It's the mountain.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would say the one that freaks me out the most is probably snow, actually. And it's because with rock and ice, I can put things into the rock or into the ice that I can just lean on and take a rest. With snow, there's not a whole lot you can do. I mean, you can put in, there's various anchors you can put into snow if it's sufficiently hard.
Mm-hmm.
But steep, powdery snow, that's kind of scary.
So when you find a resting point, you rest.
Yes.
Yeah, you like re-rest until we're ready to kind of jump this next hurdle.
Yeah, exactly. So, in terms of close calls, I mean, I'd say there's two that I would say are my closest. One is... I was doing climbing a rocky, well, it's not a rocky mountain, reminds us of our Rocky Mountain, but it was a rock climb in the Alps, and a microwave sized rock just fell. I never heard it coming, and it hadn't hit. It was just coming from so high up, like it was such a vertical face that it didn't hit anything on the way down, and I don't even hear it, and it lands between me and my friend. We're on this little rock ledge, which isn't very big, about from where I am to you. It lands right in between us and explodes. And it's big enough that even though we were wearing helmets, it would have just, you know, brained us. So that was a little freaky. There was one other time that was also kind of freaky, which is...
Sounds scary.
Yeah, that one was fun. We were at the top of this mountain, and it was this real sharp rocky pinnacle. We're at about, I think, 12,000 feet altitude. So it was a pretty long approach, and unlike the Rocky Mountains, which, you know, you might be more familiar with, like, you had to go across like a lot of glacier to get there. So you're pretty remote at this point. We're at the top of this, and all of a sudden, you know, Alps weather does this, a storm rolls in out of nowhere. Like, one minute it's perfectly sunny, the next minute it's a little cloudy, but no biggie. The next minute it's just no visibility, and it starts hailing, it starts freezing rain, so like all my gear's just getting frozen up. And then the freakiest part was that the rock itself starts buzzing. So I'm sure you've heard high voltage power lines before, right?
Yeah.
The rock was making that noise.
So you're on a rock.
I'm on the top of this mountain, which is like this kind of sharp rock, and the rock itself is going like, and I'm just like, I don't think this is good. I really don't think this is good. And so I'm with a friend, and I'm just like, we got to get out of here now. So we're going down this mountain as fast as we can. We're rappelling in the rain.
Anything happen to it?
No. So lightning never hit. I was really expecting lightning to hit, and I was trying to get down as fast as I could.
How does lightning work? That's a dumb question, seemingly, but...
That is... I don't think it's a dumb question.
I think it's more complicated than people...
I think it is, too. Yeah.
Does it start at the ground? Or does it start in the sky?
That's a good question. I don't know. I thought it started in the sky. But it might start on the ground.
I thought it had to find a place to hit.
Yeah.
I don't know, though.
I don't know.
That's what I've heard. Because I would just think if it's buzzing.
I think it starts... Yeah, I'm not sure.
Google it.
We could totally Google it.
Oh, I don't have internet here. Use your phone or
something. Yeah, we could check that out. Yeah.
Hey, Google. Where does lightning start?
Oh my gosh. It starts with Zeus.
The answer is both. Cloud to ground lightning comes from the sky down, but the part you see comes from the ground up.
Interesting.
Oh.
Interesting.
A typical cloud to ground flash lowers the path of negative electricity.
Huh.
That we cannot see.
Oh, this makes sense, though, because, like, yeah.
Objects on the ground generally have a positive charge. Yeah, so it's...
Yeah, yeah. So it's the electrons coming from the cloud to the ground, uh-huh. And then... Interesting, yeah.
And then they work their way up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah, I was a little freaked out.
To be on that.
I was a little freaked out.
So when you're climbing, I want to get to your descent of the mountain, but while you're even doing this, like walking through glaciers, do you ever just realize, like, I have to walk back? Like, are you the whole time, are you like, every step forward I take, I have to undo that step?
Yeah. And I don't know if it's a true statistic, but it's kind of a commonly held belief in the mountaineering community is that most accidents occur on the descent. And I don't know if that's just due to the fact that descending is objectively more dangerous, or mm-hmm. if it's there's a number of reasons that could be the case. But one of them is probably because like the snow in the evening is actually going to be softer, more likely to avalanche. A lot of accidents occur from avalanches. Some of it's going to be
timing.
Some of it's going to be your fatigue. You know, you've already gone up. Now you're exhausted and you've probably lost that psych you had, you know, that kind of like adrenaline you had to get to the summit. So now
do people do drugs? To like get pumped up and get hyped.
I've never really heard of that. I mean, I know of some, you know, drugs that people will take if they get altitude sickness, but I don't think it's like
no PEDs.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
No cocaine. I was just thinking of like you lost that psych. Just
I mean, people will drink obscene amounts of coffee, but I haven't really heard of people doing like cocaine.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I was wondering if maybe you knew someone's like, oh, there he is, snorting his coke again.
I mean, you'll see people at the rock climb, you know, at the crag, like, you know, at a 20-foot piece of rock climbing up it, you know, smoking a joint. But that's kind of the only drug use I've really seen in the in the climbing community. I mean, the climbing community likes their drugs. I just don't. I'm serious.
But
like,
not
for the purpose of climbing better.
Descending or ascending a mountain.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So anyway, so you're coming down.
Mm-hmm.
Terrified.
Yeah. Pretty scared. Pretty scared. By the time we got about like, you know, 30 yards down. I'm just lucky the conversion's one-to-one. I don't have to do math on this podcast. Yeah. But you're coming down and the rain's coming down and the rope just keeps getting stuck. So there was one point where I actually had to climb up to get the rope unstuck in a pretty free way. So like at that point, if I had fallen, I would have really gone for quite a ways to get the rope unstuck so we could continue down the mountain.
F. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, that was not a great part, but.
How many, did you think of any part of your life that you would miss? Were you like, I just need to be focused on climbing down?
I was pretty focused. So I generally don't get too freaked out when, you know, stuff starts hitting the fan in the mountains, fortunately. It was pretty sobering when that rock hit. Like, that actually kind of shook me up. And at that point, I was pretty ready to kind of abandon the trip. Generally speaking, I don't like lose focus though. I mean, I just, you know, I know that the safest thing is just going to be keep focused, keep going. Like,
yeah,
that's going to be the best way to do it.
That sounds nuts, man. I don't know anyone that's
ever adrenaline's a heck of a drug, man. Like once you got the adrenaline pumping, it's not an issue really. Yeah.
Whew. That sounds crazy.
It's a lot of fun.
Is there anything in the like rock climbing community that is very, I don't know, like little problems that they have? Like I know in powerlifting, some things that we do is like we look out for blood because like your shins bleed a lot when you deadlift.
Right.
And so like, interesting. You can spread blood. So yeah. You always want to be careful to like wipe bars down and make sure you're safe in that way. And we, you know, talk about breathing. We talk about, you know, just we have our own sort of techniques and little details that as you get better, you learn more and more.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the rock climbing community that's like going into rock climbing, you didn't expect to learn like how important something was and you started figuring out the importance of it?
It's actually, I mean, the funny thing is I think there might be more things. Like it's almost the entire sport is that actually.
Yeah. Just learning new skills,
learning new skills. And just, I remember when I got started rock climbing, so I kind of came at it from I had been hiking and I had hiked progressively harder mountains. And it kind of got to the point where you started needing a rope basically. And that's kind of how I got into this, you know, into what I would call technical climbing, and technical mountaineering. So for me, the difference between like technical climbing or technical mountaineering and, you know, hiking mountaineering is basically the gear. And what type of gear you need. So for a lot of hiking, mountaineering, even if there is snow involved, a lot of times you can just kind of walk up it and it's fine. But there comes a point where either due to, you know, the steepness or the terrain, there's rock or ice or snow, you have to put on a rope. And there's just so many things about rope work that are just super important. So, you know, you always want to make sure when you're climbing that you have three pieces of gear to equalized in a specific way for your anchor so that if one of them blew, you know, the other two would hold. And it's kind of funny. You learn all these like just dogmas of the sport and you think about them sometimes like, why does it need to be three? It could just be two, you know? And sure enough, like a lot of times when you're climbing in the mountains, a lot of those dogmas kind of go out the window because speed is safety. So you're better off. It is. I mean, like the story I just told. Exactly. If I'd gotten down the mountain faster, I wouldn't have had to worry about the afternoon thunderstorm. And frankly, I'd rather have a you know, two pieces of gear in my anchor than get struck by lightning. But
so it's almost tough to enjoy the top of the mountain, especially when you're ice climbing, I guess.
Yeah, because you're thinking about the descent.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you want to enjoy it, but at the same time, you're like, we got to get the fuck out of here.
It's very true. Yeah. And it's funny because like...
Do you ever take a beer with you and just drink it when you're done at the top, or do you just wait until...
So I did that when I was... Like when I first kind of started and I was doing real easy stuff, I would sometimes like... Once we brought a bottle of wine and just like finished it halfway up. But once you get into kind of some of the more technical stuff, you really want to have as much of your faculties as you can. Like,
better be sober.
The way I like to think of it is you want to have a reserve.
Mm-hmm.
You never, you know, it's mountaineering is one of the few sports where you're never pushing your limits. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of stuff out of your control. So like in soccer, you know, if you push yourself too hard, you take a breather, you're fine. And you know, pretty much any other sport, like you really either want to, you want to push yourself to the max.
Or even in the, it's one of the sports that, And I guess you could train for mountaineering by doing different exercises.
Right.
Doing wall climbs.
Yep.
Climbing with certain fingers or certain hand positions or, you know, but
there's a ton of ways to train.
But in general,
you always want a reserve of
energy. When you're climbing on a mountain, you never push yourself.
You the key thing is you just want to have this reserve of energy so that if like that rock had hit my friend, I could get him down.
So how important is your cardio to all of this?
It's very important. You have to have good cardio. And that's kind of one of my one of the weaker things for me. Like I don't have great cardio. And it's been a limiting factor. Like
is your cardio your lungs or your muscles? Your muscles get tired.
Now we're getting into more biology than I'm super
familiar with. Well, like do you feel
your but it's both.
Your
it
breath
is,
give out or do you feel your arm give out first?
Like it's generally going to be so it's not like again, it's not that either gives out.
Mm-hmm.
Usually. It's that if I'm tired, I know that I've pushed it too far. If I'm like really tired and having trouble going on. So there've been a few mountains where I kind of got down and I was just like really running on fumes. And so my takeaway from that mountain was not like, oh, that was an awesome trip. I'm so glad that I pushed myself to the limit. It was, that was dangerous. I should never do that again.
Right.
Because I was at a point where if anything had gone wrong, I would not have been able to get myself out of that situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had friends who've been helicopter rescued.
As
far as I'm concerned, the helicopter, yes, it exists in some places, but if you have to rely on that, you should be dead. Yeah. You know, like that's the sort of thing that at that point you got lucky. You could have died.
Nah, that's terrifying.
So, yeah.
I think that's weird or not weird, but it is different than other sports. So like in powerlifting, for instance, when you get ready for a meet.
Yeah.
You never want to train, or at least I've never trained, and I've always done well in meets. I never trained to 100% ever. Like you never train to failure in the gym.
Right.
But you get close, right? You do like 90%, but you never do
100
because you save it for the meet. But it sounds like climbing. It's like the opposite. All the accessory work you can do for it, you hit it.
You can hit that
as hard
max.
As you can.
Exactly.
But the minute you're on a mountain... Yep. Chill out.
Make sure you have reserves. And so,
do you take food? Do you take drinks?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to be careful with that too, because like sometimes I've had all my water freeze because I didn't. It was so cold that all my water froze, and I just went the whole day without water, and that sucked. That sucked really bad. And so that's the sort of thing. Like again, you need these reserves. You need to be able to know that you can do the mountain without water, for example, because your water might freeze. You know, need to know that you could do the mountain without food because your food could fall out of your backpack. Like I've had that happen too, where my water like breaks in the pack and just all spills out. And you know, like stuff happens.
Damn. That sounds fun.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And so obviously you can't plan for everything, you know. There are times when you know, the best laid plans go awry, but in general, you want to have a reserve and you want to be able to react to what gets thrown at you.
Sorry. I went kind of ADHD on the mountain thing.
No, I could talk about this for another 2 hours.
I do want to get, I want to wrap up the Higgs boson thing.
Yeah.
So y'all, eventually you crashed enough particles at high enough energies.
Pretty much.
How did you know you found the Higgs boson? Because you can't see the damn thing.
No, you can't see the damn thing. This is really where my work came in, and that of like the other 5,000 people. it's kind of sleuthing. So let me think if I can find an example. It really is sleuthing. So you know, there might say you're looking for an invisible human. You know, you're not going to be able to see them because they're invisible. But you can find like fingerprints, you can find footsteps, things like that. And so you're kind of doing the same thing with the Higgs boson. And the way that works with the Higgs boson is in how it we call it decays. So when subatomic particles, they have a limited lifespan. So kind of like, uranium, over time, uranium is going to decay to a different element. And there's various elements that are radioactive and they all decay. Like that, the Higgs is, you could think of it as radioactive. It's going to decay. And the lifetime at which it does that is like a very, very, very small fraction of a second. I think moving at like the speed of light, it gets like less than a millimeter away from its original creation point before decaying.
Oh, it's quick.
It's real fast. And so when it decays, it can, because it gives everything mass, it has to be able to interact with everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it can decay into almost any other thing that exists.
F.
Yeah. So kind of what you want to do is you want to find the rarest things and look for those. Because although you could create those really rare things just by slamming protons into each other some other way, there are going to be a lot more of them if the Higgs were to exist. So in other words, it's kind of like if you're spraying water, or if you've got like a trash bag, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you put it in the sink and you put water into it. Most trash bags are going to leak, especially the crappy ones you get from the grocery store. But the more holes there are, the more water is going to come out, the faster it's going to come out. And so you kind of do the same with the Higgs. Like if the Higgs exists, the water is going to come out faster. Exactly. And so you look for something that's rare. And then if the Higgs exists, you'll find more of that. Okay. And so you then use statistical techniques to say, we found...
It's highly likely
that this particle must exist because we see so much more of this thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So you almost look at a distribution.
You're looking at the distributions of rare particles.
And then
how many of those are created. Yeah.
Gotcha. So then in those distributions, are you using... Is it like... I don't know, like a frequentist approach? Like, are you just doing it with things that aren't at the energy levels of the Higgs boson and then counting how many are produced and then just kind of taking...
Yes.
You know, and so then running a distribution over those? Or
there's a bunch of different ways to kind of... Like some people do it in kind of a Bayesian way. Some people do it in a frequentist. Sometimes it's kind of a mix.
Bayesian. Always do Bayesian if you can. I'm not a frequentist.
Yeah, I think a lot of our results were like basically frequentist, but with kind of some Bayesian inspiration going on there. Yeah. So generally what we're looking at is the mass. So the thing is, you know, all these particles get created, right? And they can be created from a ton of different what we call processes.
So how do they get created?
So whenever it's E equals MC squared, man. Energy equals mass.
You act like I know what the hell you're talking about.
Einstein, you know.
Energy equals mass times speed of light squared.
Exactly. So that plus. That equation, you know, which is super famous, basically tells you that energy can be converted into mass.
Mm-hmm.
And
so then the Higgs boson that's getting created. The protons
is allowing you to create new particles, provided those particles kind of could interact.
And then some of those new particles are the Higgs boson.
Exactly.
And then when the Higgs boson is created,
yep.
Is it massless?
It's not massless. It's actually quite massive.
It is massive.
Yes.
So then if it's so massive, the only reason you can't detect it is because it dies so quickly?
Yep.
Okay. So this is big.
Well,
okay. And that makes sense that it's big in mass because it's got to create a ton of other particles.
Yeah. Right? Sort of.
So then...
Not quite.
But it's got to interact with particles, right?
It has to interact with particles. That's not...
So the
mass of the Higgs is kind of a free parameter.
Okay.
Which means that it could be a lot of different masses. So that the mass of the Higgs doesn't have to be huge.
Oh.
Yeah.
Quantum physics. So then it interacts with particles, and it loses mass.
And so the way interaction in kind of a quantum mechanical sense...
Yeah,
just indicates effectively a change of, I guess you could call it a change of state. So like, for example, if an electron and an anti-electron interact, they could create a photon.
Right. But for those listening, an anti-electron is not a proton.
No.
It's actually the opposite of
an electron.
Yep.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the purest way to think of E equals MC squared is when an electron, we call it a positron, but it's actually an anti-electron, are two massive particles. And the mass of those, when they annihilate with each other, creates energy as like a photon.
Yeah. And so then with the Higgs boson, you're taking protons.
You're taking the energy of those protons because of their speed.
Right.
Which is energy. That kinetic energy from those protons.
So because they're moving so fast, is their mass not... Are they essentially just energy?
Well, they have their kinetic energy and their, you know, kind of rest energy.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But at the point when they're colliding, they're so fast.
They're so fast that it's mostly kinetic energy there. Yeah. So that kinetic energy from the protons is being turned into just a soup of particles.
And then you want to see how much rare shit's in that soup.
Exactly. Gotcha. And it gets you're basically looking for. So the way it works in practice is you're actually looking at a distribution of masses of particles, and you're looking for kind of a peak at the Higgs mass.
Okay.
So that's really kind of how it ends up working.
Fuck.
Yeah. Because.
And so was the problem with finding it, what was the, like, it doesn't seem, as you explain it, it seems very simple. Why did it take so long to find this damn thing? Was it that you had to verify
reasons.
That it was a Higgs boson?
So,
was it politics?
To be fair, my aspect of it, which is finding it from the data once the data is there, was actually relatively easy. Mm-hmm. And we basically found the Higgs not long after it could have been found. So it really was running this damn thing for long enough to make enough Higgses so that it became statistically possible to find it in the data. Yeah. So that took I think about 2-3 years. Maybe of running, since it was first turned on. I think it was 3 years later that we discovered the Higgs.
Shit.
Maybe, yeah, 3 or 4, something like that.
So you're on the paper.
I'm on the paper
for the God particle.
For the God particle.
What did you think of the name, the God particle?
It's not a great name.
Why? You a hater?
I'm a hater. It feels a little sensationalized.
I know, right?
Yeah. It.
But it is essentially the particle that makes particles, right? But I guess all particles can.
I would call it the duct tape particle.
The duct tape particle.
Because it's just a mathematical trick that makes the model work. Like, it's not something. It's not like the other particles, and it's not even that. It's not even that elegant. It was really just somebody looking at the equations and being like, "This doesn't work. Let me just throw in this thing and just YOLO it." Basically, yeah. Like. In a lot of ways, one of the reasons I left particle physics was because we found the Higgs. You know, it killed the field.
Right.
It's the least interesting thing we could have found. We'd predicted it for 60 years. And not only that, but it's not like this elegant fix that made everything else work and is beautiful. And like, you know, we can walk away from the standard model and say we've got this beautiful theory. It's not that beautiful of a theory. It's a hacked together theory with a Band-Aid on it. And not only that, but we found the Band-Aid, which means that we don't have the wherewithal to go to Congress and to go to, you know, the EU and say, oh, we know something else exciting is around the corner. We don't. We've got something that works that's really ugly. And the only reason to build another bigger CERN to look for something cooler is just hope. Really.
Yeah. So it would have been cooler had you not found it.
It would have been cooler
if we
had not found it.
Or cooler that you showed that it could not exist.
Or if we had found something different that did the same thing but wasn't the Higgs boson.
And what would that be then?
There's a lot of different theories. Okay. They would have to look like the Higgs in some ways.
Yeah.
But they could have different interactions. The mass could be, you know, outside of predicted limits. It could interact with other particles that it's not supposed to. You know, like there's some ways in which the Higgs could be a lot more interesting. Yeah.
Hold on, I have to use a restroom. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put that on. Okay, we're back.
Woo.
Sorry, I had to take another break there. I had to take a potty break. Had some beans with our nachos.
Yeah, I'll take responsibility for the beans.
Yeah,
they were a good call, but
they were delicious.
They have side effects.
Yeah, sorry, I wanted to say something. I just went to his bathroom. Do you mind if I share that? We can always edit
it
out. He reads in his bed. He's legit got a book stand to read.
Hey.
How'd that happen?
It's a good time. It's a good time to read. So,
I mean, what else are you gonna do?
Yeah, exactly. No, I like to read. Like to read.
But you also don't take a phone in your room, right?
No. So I
sleep.
Exactly. So I have a policy because I used to have hell of a trouble going to sleep. So what I basically said is no electronics in my bedroom, no electronics in the bathroom. Just that whole area of the house is just kind of relaxation. And I think a lot of that's just because, you know, the phone, you got coworkers messaging you. And I just don't like waking up at 5 a.m. wondering if, you know, because especially when you have coworkers around the world who are like in the UK or something.
Okay. And so, Will, where do you work, Will, right
now? I work for Huddle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And tell people how you work for Huddle. Like, if you work for Huddle, what does that entail? People listening to this. This is an impressive man here. I just want to let you know that. He's done well for himself. He deserves everything he's got. hard worker.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So what is it like working? What is the day-to-day routine of working for Huddle?
The day-to-day for Huddle? Well, Huddle's a sports video company, and we're basically trying to build products, generally software, also some hardware these days, to help coaches and athletes and teams. And I work on I'm on the research and development side of things, and the work I've been doing lately is soccer analytics. So trying to use spatiotemporal player tracking data to identify key moments, tactical insights from that data. It's a really exciting field because the data is new. It's been around, you know, a few years now, but there hasn't been a lot of public facing research on kind of how to use it. And so I've been really, really lucky to kind of be able to publish some papers on that, give some talks on that.
But the big thing is, and I'm trying to get here, you work remotely.
I do.
Everyone at Huddle does. Mostly.
No. Mostly. No, we have a mothership in Nebraska.
But there's only one mothership, right?
Nope. There's a big office in Nebraska, big office in Omaha, big office in London, big office in Sydney. Now there's an office in the Netherlands.
So how many people work remotely?
There's probably maybe a fourth of the company.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not. I thought it was the majority of you work.
It's definitely not the majority. No, gotcha. No. I'm a bit of a exception on that.
Yeah. Before we get into Huddle, I know I keep bouncing around. Dude, my ADHD is is working.
Yeah.
We're looking good. Sorry, people. I want to finish the mountain story.
Okay.
You basically just descended down the mountain as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you do after that? Did you thank God you didn't die?
Pretty much, yeah. That was pretty much it. Yep. So we got down and got back on the glacier. So we were climbing the rock, which is this big pinnacle of rock that just sticks out of this kind of sea of ice.
And by rock, you mean it's a mountain, basically.
A mountain of rock, yeah. But some mountains are kind of more snowy. This one was just rock.
Yeah. I just think when people hear rock, they think, oh, it's...
Yeah.
Just a big ass rock, and it's like it is, but it's not.
Yeah. It wasn't. There's bigger ones. This one was, I would say, 900 feet, maybe 1,000 feet tall. So then out of the snow.
So then below it was even more. It was more mass below.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. But once you get down, you're on the glacier, and the glacier is relatively flat. So we actually walked across the glacier for about 2 hours. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about the Alps is they have these refuges, and they're basically these like huts that are built like sometimes on top of the snow, sometimes into the sides of mountains. And they're manned by, you know, kind of various people. They're usually supplied by helicopters, and you can go there, get a hot meal, find a tiny bed, that probably has never been washed. And so we went to one of those and stayed the night there and then got back to town the next day, descended all the way. Yeah.
That sounds scary. That's cool though, man. It's cool that you experienced that stuff.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to finish that story because we started there and then we got back into particle physics, went to mountain climbing, back to particle physics. Then I came out, changed up like the whole topic again. You're dealing with a lot.
Yeah.
You're
well, a patient man. It's fun. I wish the ending of that story is more interesting. Like, you know, we had to fight wolves on the descent or something, but no, not a whole lot happened.
Just a walk.
Not a whole lot. It's just a walk. Walk yeah.
leisurely.
I mean, if I can make it more exciting, we did jump across a few crevasses. So on the glacier, because the glacier kind of flows like a river, you'll have rapids. And in the rapids, because, you know, the glacier is ice, it'll actually create these fissures.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll have, you know, maybe 50 feet deep chasms.
If you fall.
You fall, you're going for a ride.
You're going to die?
Possibly. People have survived falling into... It depends on how deep it is. It depends on if you get wedged in at some point.
Oh, shit.
Like, it's generally not good, but you don't necessarily die.
Oh, my gosh.
And the other thing is we were roped together. So, like, one of the reasons you... So, even though you're going on what's fairly flat, you actually will keep your harness on and keep a rope between you, and each of you has an ice axe. And the idea is if one person... So... It's obvious. It's easy to avoid them when you can see them, but sometimes they'll be covered by a thin layer of snow or like an ice bridge or something. And sometimes you'll be crossing an ice bridge that you know is over a crevasse, and you're just hoping it holds. But in those sorts of situations, the other person is kind of at the ready with their ice axe, and if you do fall in, they slam their ice axe into the ground and try to hold you, catch the fall. So I've never really had that happen. I've never fallen in. And this was, I think, pretty late in season. So for the most part, most of the crevices were pretty visible. So you could just see it and then jump over it. Just kind of get a running jump and land on the other side, be fine.
F all that. That sounds so terrifying. How long have you been not putting any electronics in your room?
That has been about close to a year. Close to a year, yeah.
Big difference?
It has. I've slept a lot better. Like before that, I would always find myself kind of waking up in the morning and checking my phone. And then that would just wide awake at that point. Whether it's 6 a.m. and you're like, oh, I'm just going to check my phone. Or like, you know.
Yeah.
And so now I can sleep in better.
That's always nice.
Yeah.
Do you ever get nervous while your phone's away from you?
I've learned that it doesn't matter. You know, having done it for a year, when I first started doing it, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to wake up and there's going to be all these messages and everybody's going to be mad at me and, you know, that I haven't responded. And, you know, people at work are going to be pissed because I don't care. I just don't care anymore. I realized that the world just doesn't need me. You know, the world is going to be perfectly fine without me. It was fine before I was born. It was fine. And it will be fine for, you know, 8 hours while I don't have my phone.
You're going to make a great dad one day. Son, the world.
The world does not need
it
you.
It doesn't need you. Yeah.
No. All right. Yeah.
That's cool. I've tried to do it and I get so anxious without my phone.
Yeah.
That it, I end up.
It takes like a few.
I just go get it and I'm like.
It takes a few weeks of commitment, I think.
Yeah.
The other thing is you got to find something, especially kind of over those few weeks to kind of replace it. So for me, like reading, you know, just kind of sitting down and reading and just enjoying that. Mm-hmm. I know this is going to sound super stupid, but I love, they're not like straight up picture books, but they're kind of picture books.
What are they?
So I basically, any book I can find on history that's got like a ton of pictures.
Nice.
Because I like to just flip through, you know, see the pictures, read the captions, kind of learn a little something. It's something that's like, I don't have to really engage with it. I can kind of fall asleep on it.
Uh-huh.
But it's engaging enough that it's just fun. So I recently read one, this is going to sound very stupid, on aircraft carriers.
Boring, not stupid.
So I now know every aircraft carrier from every fleet in the world.
Like you haven't memorized?
No, but I've seen pictures of all of them.
There you go.
Yeah. That counts. Yeah.
I could know what one is and what one close to it looks like too.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't read as much as I should.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
Yeah.
It's so busy. I guess I do read, but it's all on my phone.
Yeah. You
know, books on my phone or.
The other thing I do, which has helped, is I wear computer glasses. And it helps cut down the blue light. So especially in the evenings, it helps you kind of relax a little bit.
What are computer glasses?
It's basically just like glasses.
You literally just get on Amazon, type in computer glasses?
Yeah, just get on it. Exactly. That's exactly what you do.
I've never heard of it.
It's just glasses that basically block like the blue light.
I'll have to check yours out.
Or the UV light. And it helps. It's supposed to help with eye strain. It's supposed to prevent your eyes from. So I used to. I mean, I've always kind of worked with computers for a long time.
Right. Because they're awesome.
Because they're awesome. Yeah. And after like a few days of like intense computer usage, my eyes would start to like sometimes even kind of twitch and start to hurt even. And so I would either have to stop using the computers or just suck it up and deal with it. So once I've switched to using computer glasses, I can. Yeah.
That's like definitely something you can't complain to your dad about. Like,
yeah.
Oh, my work's so hard. My eyes hurt. And he's like, shut what? Your eyes hurt. Like, shut the fuck up.
When I work, my back hurt.
Yeah.
My legs hurt.
Yeah, like real body parts.
My eyes were fine, but.
Yeah. Real body parts.
Real body parts. Yeah. Exactly.
Your eyes. Get over
my
it.
Eyes.
Put an eye patch on. It'll be all right.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine saying that. Like, oh my God, I work so hard. What's going on? My eyes just hurts a little bit.
Yeah. No, they do say though that blue light is just like kind of programmed to wake you up.
Yeah, it I mean obviously the evolution, I think anyone could surmise that, but
yeah,
they say it does something with your alpha waves in your brain, I believe.
I'm going to go with a solid. I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you're reading history books.
I love history.
And you're talking about the Vietnamese War, basically.
Yeah, the Vietnam War.
Vietnamese
the
War.
Cold War, yeah.
Cold War. What do you think of our country after reading more about that?
It's kind of eye-opening. I mean, one interesting thing you kind of take away is that immoral leaders is something that's not terribly new. I kind of enjoy it from a few perspectives, just because, I mean, from the American perspective, it's very interesting. It kind of feels like the more things change, the more it stays the same. In terms of you have leaders who, as a world power, constantly feel like they have to kind of cut moral corners in order to bring about a greater good. And you can kind of see how that sort of power, like, leads people to make decisions that in retrospect seem really wrong. But at the time, you can kind of understand why they felt like that was the right decision. So even with Nixon, you know, reading about Nixon in the context of the Cold War, you kind of recognize that Watergate, very bad, but it's the last in a long list of very covert
spy, or not spy, but
operations that were done because there was so much fear and so much just inbuilt need to be in control of as much as they possibly could be in control of.
Well, yeah, I remember reading, not read, I don't read, listening to a talk about during the Cold War when we had planned, and like all these documents are public now, so you can read them if you want. This is all true. None of this is speculative at this point. But we planned essentially a propaganda attack on Cuba to enter into war with them. And it was like plans ready to go, and we did it, obviously. Right. Like not war, but we like had sanctions on them and things of that nature.
Yeah.
And all of that came to light. I don't know when the documents were released for the public, but
right.
It's just, it's shady, and well, that's why I think...
The truth is the first casualty of war, and when you're in, like, a decades-long war, even if it's not always hot, like the Cold War, the truth is the first thing to go. Because...
I think it's important to know these things, and I think for, you know, I don't want to get too much into politics, because whatever. Everyone's got strong opinions, someone gets pissed, whatever, I don't want to deal with that, but...
Politics is a better discussion to have kind of one-on-one.
Yeah, it's also like you just can't trust, you can't trust anyone with power. Like, it's not these, like, I don't think it's the people in power are bad. I think it's you give them power and they start getting bribes. You know, someone's like, hey, why don't you vote on this? And we'll give you, you know, $100,000.
Right.
You know, we'll give you, you know, $500,000 if you just, you know.
Yeah.
Put a vote and get... Guessing your buddies to vote will help you out here. And then eventually that power just corrupts people.
Well, what I say is, you know, to anybody who doesn't understand how politicians are corrupt or how, you know, kind of world leaders, you know, do so many evil things, just go play Crusader Kings.
What's that?
It's a video game. And in the video game, you know, you have all these diplomatic options, like have your sell your son off to somebody else to marry somebody's daughter so that you can get the right... to claim a king, you know, like it, all your morality goes out the window in that game, like very fast. I was like, you know, like, me, I would never sell my daughter to somebody else, like for a title to land. That would be terrible. Also me. Okay. Let's see. Can I get the Duchy of Saxony by selling Felicia, like, or, you know, Bruce, like,
No, man. Yeah. So I just think people need to, let's just not give the government a lot of money and power. We'll just keep that to ourselves.
Yeah,
that's crazy. You know, I love this country, but
yeah,
there's definitely a shady past a shady present.
Yeah. I think
shit going on all the time.
The other thing that's been very interesting for me kind of studying this is just the humanization of, you know, the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So like recognizing kind of what motivated, you know, the Viet Cong and the Viet Minh leadership, recognizing kind of the motivations of the Soviet leadership in World War II. One book I read recently was called The Dead Hand, and it talks about kind of weapons of mass destruction in as they were developed in the Cold War, and basically how close the world came to absolute destruction, either by biological, chemical, or nuclear war, repeatedly. And you know, you get leaders even like Mikhail Gorbachev, who's a very progressive leader, like really wanted peace. And yet he's somebody who, on his watch, some of the most dangerous pathogens in the world has ever seen were ever developed, like strains of plague that are incurable.
What happened to them?
It's a good question.
Damn you, Russia.
It's a good question.
Yeah. Have you seen, oh my gosh, what's it called? I'm blanking. Don't blank. Icarus on Netflix?
No.
It's about the steroid scandal with Russia.
Oh, interesting.
Basically Russia has a state-supported doping.
Right.
Agency.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's when you have the Olympic Games, people are going to... I think steroids should be legal, personally, because people are obviously taking them anyways.
Yeah.
Like, Lance Armstrong never failed a drug test.
Yeah.
Never failed. He's never been caught.
Yeah.
He admitted it
because
I think someone was going to rat him out. So he was like, I got to get ahead of this. And
right.
He comes out, admits it. But he's never, like, doping tests are easy to fool.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Russia proved it. Their track and field mm-hmm. has been banned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard about that.
They're like, and then other competitors have to compete under the Olympic flag. They can't compete for Russia.
Yeah, I heard about that.
I mean, it's bullshit. That's pretty interesting. I think it's bullshit that they're even in if steroids are banned. But at the same time, you look at when Carl Lewis
mm-hmm.
got beat by Ben Johnson, the Canadian.
Yeah.
Carl Lewis tested positive for a PED.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Ben Johnson. But Ben Johnson was Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
So they stripped him of his medal and gave it to Carl Lewis. And Carl Lewis, when he tested positive, they said it was he was... What was it like? He basically took it by accident. It was a something, chemical that was in a tea that he took, and he didn't know the chemical was in the tea. And you can see all these letters; they're all public, also.
Yeah.
But that's bullshit. Like it's like America just pushed around Ben Johnson, who did cheat.
Yeah.
So did Carl Lewis. So did probably the dude in third place. So did everyone running that track meet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people just are gonna take steroids when you're a professional. When you're a professional athlete, sorry, I'm super ranting about this, but if you're a pro athlete and the only way you made money was being really good at a sport, and someone said, hey, I have this oil that you can inject in your body, it's relatively harmless. Mm-hmm. Like, there are no studies that show it's super dangerous, minus Trend. Trend's fucking crazy. But minus Trend, they're all pretty safe. In fact, they're like health benefits that are tied to them now. And they said, hey, you could take this and you'll be really good at your sport. You'll recover faster. You can eat a little bit looser now. You don't have to be so strict on your diet.
Mm-hmm.
Would you do it? Probably. If you're making millions of dollars a year, you're like, fuck it. Like, whatever. I might as well take it.
Yeah.
I just don't see. I mean, just make them legal. That's me, though.
I mean, I can see. It's just something I can see both sides of.
Yeah.
There is something to be said for you got to just keep playing, you know.
Play fair.
No, not so much play fair. Because obviously, you know, people are going to cheat. But I think there's something to be said for if you don't ban things, things will spiral out of control. Like, there's always going to be a line you draw somewhere.
Yeah, but why?
And so I think your options are either draw it, like, pretty strictly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to have the problem of people are going to, you're going to have habitual line steppers.
Yeah.
Or don't draw it at all, in which case... You're going to have people take it. Like, then it's like, let's avoid things that are dangerous for you. But people are going to continually do things that are dangerous for them in an attempt, you know, like in an attempt to get an edge.
Not to be completely, but you're already an athlete. Like, that's already dangerous. It's hard on your body. Like, look
at
football.
It depends on the sport. It does depend on the sport.
Football players,
it's very dangerous.
All the time. Boxers, anything where you're doing collision, soccer players can get CTE.
Yeah.
You know, and has it been shown that, like, heading the ball gives you CTE or, like,
I've heard some studies about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Back
into soccer. Look at that.
Right. Segway. All the way back into soccer.
Go ahead.
So
we're going to talk about soccer now.
Let's do it.
But has that been shown that heading balls, like, fucks
up? I've heard that might be the case. I don't know for sure. I should probably should know that.
Whatever. They have another data scientist for that. More researchers and doctors on that one.
I mean, it sure as heck isn't as bad as
the
collisions you're having in the NFL.
What's some cool stuff you've done? And so, like, what is the goal of applying data science to soccer? Like, you gotta explain to someone.
Yeah. There's a few goals. So.
Goals.
Plenty. There's a few objectives. So just to kind of give you a sense of what's going on in a club, inside a club, you know, everybody's familiar with the athletes because you see them out there pretty much every day, you know, playing the game. You're also familiar with the manager because he's going to be on the sidelines. You know, in football, it'd be like Bill Belichick, you know, the other assistant coaches, et cetera. In soccer, it's going to be, you know, like Pep Guardiola, Jose Mourinho, Jurgen Klopp. And they're on the sidelines kind of, you know, directing the match. What you don't see really is kind of what's going on behind the scenes with them. And so some of it you can kind of guess. Like, obviously, there's going to be, like, physiotherapists who are making sure the athletes stay healthy. There's going to be assistant coaches who kind of coach them on, like, more minutia things. But there's also a growing trend of analysts. And these analysts basically are trying to leverage their knowledge of the game to identify key moments that could be used by the coach to either highlight a weakness in their opponent for the next match or to maybe like shore up a deficiency of your team by looking at previous match footage, things like that. So these analysts, they have a tough job because they're watching hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of game footage just trying to put together a playlist of like key critical moments during the match.
So then can you actually develop some kind of AI to look through that film and find key moments on its own?
So building it to look straight through the film is going to be really hard, but we can take the data that goes along with the film. So, you know, there's a lot of providers of data, including Huddle. One of the big ones in the space is Opta, and they provide data about what happens during a football match. So they tell you when the passes occur, who passed to who. They tell you whether the pass was successful. You know, they tell you where even on the pitch that pass occurred. And so this data then can be used. Like, if you're an analyst and the coach comes to you and is like, okay, we are playing these guys tomorrow at 8 a.m. It's 2 a.m. right now. I really need to know. I want to look at every set piece that this team has scored a goal from in their last 30 matches. And you're like,
and see if you can find trends.
And so you're like, crap, I have to watch 30 games of footage in like the next day to find those. But now you can go to Opta and you can look and, you know, write a SQL query or a Python query to find those corners. What I'm trying to do is
hit Opta using like, is there like an API for it?
You can have an API. You can have it in like a local database.
You can like store it in your own database.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little Mongo action.
Yeah, a little Mongo. More likely SQL. But I like Mongo. Or Excel even.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. But so you've just saved this analyst a ton of time just by having this data and being able to write a 2-line SQL query. From my perspective, that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, that's just that's the low hanging fruit.
Yeah. So getting the game data.
Once you have that game data, you can answer those easy questions. Like, I want to see every, you know, piece of the video footage of these where, you know, this opposing team scored from a corner or from a set piece or whatnot. That is really expedited by having this data. There's a lot more, though, you can do with it. So, for example, you could try to identify, you could build a model. That might try to find dangerous play patterns or build, you know, kind of a Leighton Dirichlet allocation model that might.
So without getting super deep into the physics and stats and science of it, what do you work on? Or like you did a huge project for Huddle, right? Doing pass what?
Yeah, so I've had three basic kind of what I would say are self-contained projects. One is analyzing open space, so identifying points on the pitch where players have created space through their positioning relative to defenders or to attackers. The second one is a passing probability model, and so that's very useful because you can basically quantify the likelihood or the probability that a pass will be successful or fail.
Right. So it shows.
It tells you the pass difficulty.
Right. So like what that model looks like, it's really cool. It'll show players on a field, and then depending on who has the ball and who's around them, it shows red and blue areas, basically hot zones for pass probability.
Where a player could receive the ball.
Right. Yeah. So if they move there, they could get the ball in this area.
Yeah.
And it's pretty predictively accurate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of, that was one of the outputs of the model, kind of that map. It's pretty accurate. Like it does a good job of kind of predicting which passes will succeed and fail. More importantly, it really lets you tell what sort of passes are hard and difficult. And so that allows you to kind of say which players are better passers, even if they have a lower pass completion rate. So traditionally you look at players and you're like, this guy completed 70% of his passes. This guy completed 80%. The 80% passer is probably better than the 70. That might not be true though, because the guy who completed 70% may have been completing much harder long balls over the defense, right, to strikers, you know. And
so then you're able to like essentially use that model,
contextualize,
and go back and look at
completed
passes to say, you know, what's a hard pass, easy pass.
Exactly. So you can use it for scouting. You can identify players who are good at passing, bad at passing, good at receiving, bad at receiving.
Is it being used right now by people?
No, it's not running anywhere right now. So it's not in a product yet. We'd like to put it in a product at Huddle. Yeah. Maybe one day. We'll see.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, to be entirely fair, I can't say for certain that nobody's using it. One of the things about clubs is that they tend to be pretty secretive about what they're doing. And so all the details of the model are public. So it's feasible, conceivable that some clubs have implemented it and are using it internally.
And you wrote all this in Python?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
That's not public, but you could recreate the model
from
the information that's published.
So then what is public?
Just the mathematics.
Okay.
The mathematics.
Not the code?
Not the code.
That's good.
Yeah.
DNA. Then.
We don't want to make
or
it
not
too...
not DNA. What's it called? The DN... DNA. I'm so tired. What's it called? NDA.
NDA. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Secret.
Yeah. That part's secret. I mean, we don't want to make it too easy for people to copy.
Yeah. That's a lot of code.
It is quite a bit.
Then it's got to be fast, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It needs to be able to run over, you know, each game is something like 200 megabytes of data, and you've got, you know, a few hundred games. That adds up pretty fast.
Jeez.
And then the last model that I've been working on is an opportunity model. So in soccer,
you're
goals
talking about this model?
I gave a talk on it a few weeks ago in Philadelphia. So I was invited to speak at the inaugural USA first ever OptiPro analytics event. And I got to give a talk on this, which was really, really fun for me. Basically, just to kind of contextualize the model, in soccer, scoring is pretty rare. So if you're familiar with basketball or football, like, you know, matches, games, can you know, like in basketball, it can be like 91 to 120. Or in American football, it can be like 50 to 20 or something. In soccer, you're lucky if it's like 2-1, or sometimes teams don't even score. So in, you know, math language would say it's pretty stochastic. It's very random. Scoring is a very rare process. It's largely Poisson. It's a largely Poisson process, so it's occurring with some fixed rate. And you really don't know what's going to happen. So one of the issues is after a match, you go home with your pals in the pub, and you're like, we lost that, but we totally should have won. We are playing better. And so quantifying that, like, you know, anytime you can say, we should have won, that's kind of begging for a model to quantify how much we should have won by,
right,
or, you know, whether or not we should have won. And so the first attempt at that is really to just look at the number of shots. One way to tell which team was better is to see how much possession they had and how many shots they took. So generally teams that take more shots are going to score more goals. But then people realize that's true. But then sometimes a team will get ahead and then they'll just kind of turtle up. They'll defend, and the other team is going to be taking a ton of shots, but all those shots are going to be coming from super far out,
right,
and they're terrible shots, so they're low-quality shots. So they're like, oh, we need to quantify the shot quality, not just how many shots.
Yeah.
So then they kind of upgraded it to what's called an expected goals model, and it's basically a shot quality model. So, you know, this team might have taken 20 shots, but they're all crap. This team might have taken 5, but they were all like 2 yards away from the goal line. So this team was doing better.
So then what quantifies shot quality?
Shot quality is going to be based on distance from goal, number of defenders between the shot and the goal, although a lot of times that one's ignored because it's difficult to get without tracking data.
Yeah.
Then things like angle of the shot. So what angle it is, like if, you know, so the cross-sectional area available of the goal.
Okay, so if you're shooting from directly in front of the goal,
that's going to be a better
shot.
That's
a higher quality.
Than if you're shooting from an oblique angle.
Gotcha. So like quality isn't always challenging. Like I think some people might look at that and go, oh, that's a more challenging shot. And it's like, right, it's also
but it's a
lower
quality shot. Yeah. Yeah, sure, you could score from it, but it's going to take a higher quality player to score from a lower quality shot.
Right.
But you can make it as a probability. So you can say, okay, this shot on average has about a 10% chance of going in. this shot on average has a 50% shot. This is a much higher shot quality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can actually add those all up, each of those probabilities, to say throughout the course of this match, we would expect this team to score 2.39 goals on average. If this match was replayed exactly the same, this team should have scored 2.39, and this team should have scored maybe 0.27. So this team should have won, but somehow this team got lucky and scored one, and this team scored zero.
Yeah, and without getting too, I don't know what you can and can't talk about, and I really want to ask a lot of like questions about, I don't know, I love like feature analysis or or feature engineering. That's like one of my favorite parts of data science, but I don't know what I can and can't ask you about that, because that's where all the, I think that's where the magic happens in data science.
No, it's true. That's having people, that's where a lot
understand
of
the game and create good features
right
from the data that you already have.
Right.
But
no, I mean, I can talk about that. So I haven't even discussed my model yet. So that shot quality model is one that's been out for a while.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people have different variations on it.
Okay.
The extension I've done that I'm really excited about is, instead of looking at, you know, number of shots taken and how good those shots were, we actually look at basically quality of positioning. So players who don't even get the ball but put themselves in a dangerous position where they could get the ball, they get credit for that, and you can sum that up and get a total probability of scoring based on how you created space during the course of a match. So in other words, just by being a player next to the goal, a few feet away from, you know, say I'm the striker and I'm open and completely unguarded at the far post, and there's a, you know, my teammate, the winger on the left there, has the ball and he could pass to me, but he doesn't. So I never get the ball. I don't get to shoot. I don't get to score. But because I was in a dangerous position, sometimes he might pass to me, but this time he just wasn't paying attention. So there's kind of a stochastic element even to that. And so quantifying how much value I'm bringing to the team just by being in that dangerous position.
And by stochastic, you mean
random.
Putting yourself in rare positions in soccer is exactly stochastic.
Well, putting yourself there
and not getting a pass.
What is stochastic is whether or not I get the ball,
right,
whether or not I'm able to control the ball, whether or not once I control the ball, I shoot, and whether or not if I shoot, I score. So all of that's pretty random. And so what I think the game generally boils down to, and like at the pub afterwards, you're generally saying the team that should have won is the one that got open in space, in dangerous spaces more often. And I think that's really what, you know, quality teams do. And so if you can quantify that, and so I've built a model that's able to quantify that.
Yeah, but this is player independent, right?
This is player independent.
So you're not taking into account Messi or...
So you actually can.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
You actually can. Currently, I'm kind of doing that in reverse. So I'm basically building a player independent model, and then I'm calculating deviations from that model in a Bayesian way.
Right.
To identify quality players.
So if someone's killing it when they shouldn't be killing it, then you can quantify quality player.
How much he's killing it. Right. Exactly. So
how much of a quality is this player?
Because effectively there's...
Overcoming odds, basically.
Right. There's three measurable things. You can measure how much, I call it off-ball scoring opportunity, the player creates. So that's good and all, but then the team still has to get you the ball. So I call that the team getting you the ball conversion. So that's the team converting your opportunity that you've created into possession. Once you have possession in a dangerous space, and the possession can be thought of as kind of the shot quality, because like just having possession is going to be related to whether or not you take a shot. So possession then gets, if you take a shot, that's, you know, decision making. And then from the shot, there's finishing. So how good your shots are, how good you are at shooting. So that finishing is another thing you can measure.
So,
and then
so
the last
you can
thing
be high in the first two, but be in shitty positions.
Exactly.
And that's okay.
And well, that would be bad. So for
but I mean, if you're a good player,
right? Right. So if
overcoming
you're good,
those odds shows how good you are at
exactly
shot quality.
So suppose you're a player who gets in dangerous positions, but the team rarely feeds you the ball. But when they do feed you the ball, you're able to score from it.
Right.
So that would be a player who, there's two things you can take away. If you're another team, you would identify that player and say, okay, this is a player who's good at finishing. He can finish when he gets the ball. And he's good at creating space in dangerous areas. It's just the team that's not giving him the ball enough.
Right.
Let's go buy that player and let's feed him the ball. And take some player who might be kind of considered to be a not very good player because he's not getting a lot of chances to score. put him in a place where he can succeed, and then watch him flourish.
Yeah, and this is like the equivalent of what they did on Moneyball, like that classic scene where he goes, no, we should get this guy. He has more on-base percentage.
Exactly. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Fuck hits. Like, yeah. How often are you on base?
Right.
That's what's important.
Or more recently with the pitch framing.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
That's cool, man. I wish we could... We haven't been talking in a while. Yeah. We can keep talking. I like this stuff. I do have some questions, though. So, like, when you're doing all this soccer analytics, it's... Or I guess like data science on soccer, how much, I guess, in your day to day are you coding versus how much are you like reading and researching and hating, like, not because I love coding.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I rarely code. Like most of what I do is read.
Interesting. Okay. I do a lot of coding.
I do a lot of researching.
I do a lot of coding. Well. A lot of that's because I learn by coding. So when I get a new idea, I like to just kind of mock it up.
Okay.
I'll read, you know, like if there's a model or if there's like a mathematical concept that I don't fully understand and I want to know it better, I'll read about it. But I would say like 80 to 90% of it is coding.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice, man. I need to code more. I haven't coded in a while.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, we could get into a lot of stuff, dating life, all that good stuff, but I think we're going to wrap it up.
Sounds
we need
good.
To do another one before you leave.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's good talking to you.
You too, man.
Any parting words of wisdom for the people?
Let's see. You never walk alone.
That's deep.
Yeah.
That's deep. Everyone, thanks for listening. Y'all enjoy it, and we are out.
Take care.